Hello, friends. You are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. You're somewhere in a car, I bet. You're at your office, your job, you're laying down. Maybe you're with your lover, your child. Maybe you're breastfeeding right now and sweet, delicious breast juice blasting into the mouth of your newborn tot as you listen to this podcast and stare out over your beautiful Caribbean view and consider writing an email to Duncan Trussell to invite him to come stay at your place and be the father to your child because you're a supermodel whose husband was devoured by wolves somewhere far away in the Adirondacks. Thank you for listening. I love your baby. I'll hold your baby. I want to hold a baby. And I want to hold you close, oil you down, whisper in your ear, smell your flowery neck, and enjoy the many secrets of your beautiful supermodel widowed mothered body. Today's podcast is a true mind melter. The way this podcast happened only speaks to the weird power of the internet. A week ago, I went and visited my post office box, and I had received an album from my friend Ian, who sent me this incredible album with a really intense album, a beautiful cover art by a musician named Father John Misty. I'd never heard Father John Misty before, and I put it on my record player and was like, fuck, this is incredible. It's exactly the kind of music I like. Beautiful, resonant, funny, but poignant, dark, awesome, ayahuasca references, Joseph Campbell references, everything wrapped together in this incredible album. And so I just tweeted that the album was blowing my mind, and Josh tweeted back to me, because apparently he'd heard some of my podcasts before, and within a week, he manifested at my house on this podcast, which to me is more proof that the singularity is coming and that technology is allowing people to connect in the most insane, novel, and unpredictable ways. So a big thanks to you, Ian, because you're the one who manifested this thing. And for all of you out there who send me emails and books and crazy chunks of information and bizarre YouTube videos, you should understand that you're planting seeds in the soil of this podcast, and there is a high probability that those seeds can actually grow a Father John Misty here. So if there's people that you'd like on the podcast, or if there's things you'd like me to talk about on the podcast, or if you think there's stuff I should know, for example, how to pronounce Aleister Crowley. I think I mispronounced the term sigil. I don't know if it might be sigil. I think I mispronounced a lot of stuff. Little things, big things, grammar. If there's grammar errors, send it to me, because you can steer the giant unwieldy wheel of this blimp flying through the internet and keep it from smashing into the mountains of mispronunciations and ridiculous statistics that don't exist at all. At this point, I'm essentially just regurgitating all the different bits of information that you guys are blasting into my brain and all over my face and into my chest hair. So keep it coming. Keep spraying that info jizz all over the podcast because it will grow babies. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour is sponsored by a t-shirt, the only t-shirt company to ever win the Nobel Peace Prize. A lot of people don't know this, but Sure Design T-Shirts is a t-shirt company most, not just known for their t-shirts, but most known for eradicating a disease, Hexalophilus, which was a horrific disease that was plaguing Africa and Thailand. It was a terrible disease that would cause your lower body to turn into a maggot tail thing with a sharp barbed stinger at the end. And you got this disease from making out with trannies, essentially. But also, well, there was other ways you can get it, but mostly from making out with trannies. And so, isn't it? A lot of people wouldn't report when they were getting the initial symptoms of the disease because they were embarrassed for some dumb reason. And it's also known as Murphy syndrome. But there would be these scales would begin to appear on your body. That's the first sign. These dark, oily, black scales would start appearing on your legs. And these would spread, and then eventually your legs would seal together with a kind of sticky gelatinous ooze that made it impossible to separate your legs. This would cause testicle compression, and which is a terrible thing, painful situation. But eventually your genitals would just mold into the wormy gelatinous oval that your lower body had turned into, and then the stinger would emerge, and you'd just start stinging yourself. You'd sting yourself to death, and it was a horrible death. But the people at Sure Design T-shirts, they went into the laboratory. They risked their lives by making out with over 7,000 trannies until finally they contracted the disease, and they realized that a combination of solar energy mixed with the codeine drink that the rappers drink, known as Sazerup, if you shot light rays, pure morning dawn light rays through Sazerup, it would create this concoction that you could then massage into the larva body of the victim who had contracted the disease, and they'd go back to normal. And they eradicated the entire disease. So now we get to make out with trannies without having to worry about this horrible disease. So they're an incredible company. They won a Nobel Peace Prize for that. And they used that money to research how to soften their fabrics even more. They make some of the softest t-shirts available to man or woman, and they wanted them softer because puppy ears and the undercarriages of koalas are soft, and that's the main thing that they use to create these beautiful shirts, but they're just not soft enough. They needed them softer. And so they found out that by peeling away the very top layer of flesh from the skin of a newborn Illuminati child. There's some of the Illuminati families are still giving birth in the normal vaginal way. Most of them, of course, have started or giving birth through implanting their venomous spit in the chests of people in some of the Iraq or Afghanistan, and allowing their foul offspring to explode from within the chest of those people. But some of them still do pussy birth. And they, as a matter of tradition, because they owe a great debt to Sure Design T-shirts for making it safe for them to make out with trannies, because there's nothing more than the elite of the world love than feeling the thick, gooey coke tongue of a tranny running up and down their reptilian backs. So as a gift, as a tribute, when an Illuminati child is born, they will shave off the very top layer of skin from its neck, and they'll mail that in an ice envelope to Sure Design T-shirts, and they put that into their batch of T-shirts, and it makes some of the softest shirts on the planet. If you don't believe me, order one. Go to SureDesignT-shirts.com, enter my name, you get 10% off. They've got amazing shirts, amazing yoga outfits, amazing beach wear. It's an incredible company. Hello, Bennett. I love you. Thank you for sponsoring this podcast. They're magnificent. We are also sponsored by an amazing company. I'm sure you've heard of them. Audible, the distributors of digital books. God knows how many forests have been saved, how many leprechauns and forest nymphs and hoofed pan creatures have been saved from having their woodland homes transformed into 600 Shades of Pale or some other crap beach book, thanks to Audible, who have some of the greatest voiceover actors on the planet read these incredible books. I've just been listening to a wonderful book called Inside Scientology, which is mind-blowing and gives a pretty objective biography or history of Scientology. And you can get that book for free if you go to audibletrial.com/familyhour and type in, we don't have to type in anything, audibletrial.com /family hour. You sign up for a trial membership, you get a free audiobook, and you can listen to Inside Scientology, which will give you this spooky respect for a notorious man, L. Ron Hubbard, and his incredible ambition and all the insane things that he pulled off. It's a really great book. And there's a million other good books like the Dark Tower series. Go there and check that out. They give me $15. It helps support the podcast. It's a way for you to donate if you don't feel like donating. But if you do feel like donating, you can go to DuncanTrussell.com and click on the donate button and send some green energy my way. If you like this podcast, why not throw in the amount that you would pay for a Starbucks or a butt plug or deodorant or whatever the essential aspects of your life are? Why not give us a little bit of that green energy? You don't have to. But to those of you who have, thank you for keeping this form of entertainment growing and spreading its tendrils through the ear holes of so many people living on planet Earth right now, or through their car speakers, or through their crib speakers, or through the new eternal life speakers that they've been putting in the caskets of certain people that I've heard about. So you can listen to music for 500 years as your body decomposes. You're the ones keeping that going by donating to the podcast. You could also go to the shop and order one of our t-shirts or posters. We also have stickers there. And if you don't feel like doing that, that's totally cool. This is free entertainment. But why not go to the forum, join the forum, and start having the conversation, the mini conversations that people are having there about insane topics. We try to keep the trolls out. Anybody who's got a case of brotesterone and is throwing out weird, angry crap that sometimes you see on other message boards, we ban them instantly. So it's a cool place. It's a fun place to check out. If you've never been to a message board, I think you'll like it. And there's a Minecraft server there too, if you play that terribly addictive, lonely game, which is really fun to play. But man, it really will suck you in. There's a Minecraft. They have their own Minecraft server. They're their own community. It's not like a fan page. It's just a group of people who are super fucking cool and like to interact and communicate with each other, because who wants to be alone? And sometimes they actually hang out in Meet Space, which is cool. So go there, join the forum, and say hello, would you? As I mentioned before, today's guest is a musician. His name is Josh Tillman. He is a folk singer. He was the drummer for the band Fleet Foxes. He is an incredible lyricist. He's a mystical human being. And he was brought to this podcast by the interaction of you, the listeners, with me. So this is an incredible thing. And in fact, this may be my favorite podcast ever, because he is brilliant and blew my mind. So everyone, please send your psychic tendrils to embrace and enfold, engulf, lick, massage, kiss, paint, and adore the incredible Josh Tillman, also known as Father John Misty. Links to all his stuff will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Father John Misty! Hello.
Trying to transcend my lizard brain.
I just gave Josh some alpha brain, Joe Rogan's incredible nootropic vitamins. We'll see what happens.
Everything's turning into a solid point of light.
Hold on. Do a sound check again. Hold on. Shit. Say hello.
Hello.
There we go. Do it again.
Alpha brain.
Alpha brain. Welcome to the alpha brain universe. Now you will understand.
This is the first. It's as if I have the first brain.
Julian Assange is a martyr.
Oh my God! What if that guy got my files?
That's what I keep thinking.
I kept
thinking.
Having nightmares. Like, when that was all going on, I just... This new concept formed in my brain that I had files. That there were files on me that were just one like, rogue intellectual away from being exposed.
You know what I thought? Because I was trying to empathize with the military-industrial complex, and I thought, man, fucking Julian Assange got into my browser history and posted all the porn that I looked at on Wikipedia, I'd want to put him in a fucking under the Pentagon, too.
He messed everything up for everybody.
What? How dare he? He's the guy where there's a wonderful play going on, and he stands up in the audience and says, this is not real. There's a whole backstage with Afghani kids being barbecued.
I'm surprised they didn't given the political proclivities of the Batman movies, that there wasn't like a thinly veiled Julian Assange like nemesis character in there.
Interesting. You know, it could have been in there. The Batman movies, you didn't see it. We were just talking about the way certain movies, they try to encode within the movies like heavy information that you just can't get out normally, and how that was definitely in the Batman movie. But the weird thing about the Batman movies is the opening of the Batman movie, at least in the theater I was at, Dolby sound system, the Dolby sound system graphics that pop up, it's like inside some kind of Egyptian pyramid, and all of a sudden there's this weird Egyptian symbol with light pouring through, and you're like, this is a fucking sound. These are speakers. Right. Why are you showing Illuminati, bizarre Egyptian, esoteric, Crowleyan symbols for your fucking speakers?
It's so embedded in the entertainment. Like, have you ever been to the 30th floor of CAA or anything?
No.
Like way up there.
I didn't even know.
I was up there once for a real, it's like that giant artist representation.
I know CAA is, okay. But the 30th floor, I heard, but that they have to drug you at a tiki room and wake up.
I can't totally explain why I was up there. But I look down and there are like triangles and an all seeing eye, like in the land, like all carved into the land, like the landscape.
Why do they do that?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I have a theory.
I mean, but when you consider that this country has like two major, like or just only a few major industries, one of which is like the entertainment industry.
Yes.
Kind of. I mean, money is money, you know.
Well, right. Then they want to leave their marks there. See, there's two ways to look at those symbols that are everywhere. And one way is a very dire way to look at those symbols, which is there's some kind of like dark reptilian graffiti that they leave around just to freak people out and let the others know that they've been there. Right. And the other way I look at it is like, wait a minute. This is something I've been thinking lately, is because I was just up in, I was up in Northern California, and I was at my friend's legal pot farm, and I've never been to a pot farm before. Have you ever been to a pot farm?
A legal pot farm?
Yeah.
Where they're just like cops tilling the soil, and like ex-presidents, and like...
it's like apparently legal. At least it's legal in California. If you have a prescription, you can grow five plants, and if you grow five marijuana plants, they're giant. They can become gigantic, beautiful things. So there are all these marijuana plants, and it's the first time I've been around that, and I had this feeling of being backstage. I felt like, oh fuck, this is backstage of capitalism. We're behind the facade, because this is a bubble of what is activity that the federal government has said is illegal. And so in the same way, I wonder if those Illuminati symbols that you see everywhere are signs to people who are operating from backstage that it's not such a terrible place that you think you're in. Like, super smart people actually have retreated out of the bubble of popular culture and are existing somewhere in the shadows, and they want you to know, look, it's okay.
Yeah.
There's smart people out there. You're not alone. There's really, really smart people out there.
Yeah, I kind of take the standard contrarian attitude regarding certain conspiratorial affectations like that, which is that human beings generally are not, like, there's no truth in a mob. Like, you can't get X number of people together. Like, secret societies are almost, like, completely, destined to be ineffective or fail or whatever, simply because you cannot get human beings together in any kind of bureaucratic sense and have them be, I mean, I don't
I know that.
You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
But, yeah, I don't know. I just like looking at crazy eyeballs from 30. You know, if it anything that can that helps instill like some sense of mystery or something in an otherwise pretty banal world,
yeah,
I'm cool with that.
Well, yeah, me too. I love it. And that idea of like that idea that, okay, yeah, there's no way that people are going to organize themselves in such a way that they could actually have any kind of true effect on society
without Julian Assange or Batman or somebody coming in and fucking it
up. Well, see,
everybody.
Whenever you see Julian Assange getting put up, you know, having to retreat into an embassy to escape mm-hmm. from the powers, then there is this sense of like, oh shit, it's fucking real. He's yeah. like made it so that they have had to pop out of the woodwork for a second,
right.
And it's fucking annoying for them
yeah.
because they.
I mean, it's yeah. I mean, or if you look at like somebody like Elliot Spitzer or something, just how like, just kind of how easy it was to just completely, deal with dismantle his whole thing, like to completely neutralize his effect or presence or something like, and that was coming from high ups in the financial industry,
right?
You know, I mean, they can definitely. There are definitely people mobilized to be able to like secure their interests.
Yes, there. Well,
yeah.
For sure.
And
it happens in every. It's like you get these. It's like you have nature,
mm-hmm.
and then out of nature we spring out of nature, and then these bubbles in nature form, and the bubbles are called societies, and those bubbles. Mm-hmm. have within them this game that everyone's playing in a language that everybody's speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside those bubbles, other bubbles spring up. And those other bubbles that spring up are what's known as cults, right? And
mm-hmm.
so you get these cults that spring up within the big bubble, popular
mm-hmm.
culture. It's a cult, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially a cult. That's why they call it culture. It's a
yeah.
cult. So popular
yeah.
culture is like the accepted cult. And then you get these bubbles that spring up that are these less accepted cults, one of them being Scientology, which I'm reading this amazing book called Inside
mm-hmm.
Scientology. And fucking Hubbard, at one point, infiltrated the United States government and was like, had his people in like the highest offices taking files out and scanning them to see what information they had.
Mm-hmm.
So my point in that is that if a little fucking bubble like Scientology managed to organize in a way that they could infiltrate the big bubble,
right.
then the big bubble has got to be super fucking organized. Like,
yeah. But yeah, and the ideological mystification required, like, I'm thinking about pop culture as a cult. Like, if a way in which to define a cult is membership by virtue of some element of exclusivity.
Sure.
Money is, even though it permeates everything, it is still based on scarcity.
Yes.
And is thus, like, exclusive in some way. So, like, popular culture and the ability to interact with popular culture is based on the exclusivity of possessing enough in, you know, disposable income, you know, to take part.
Sure. Right.
But yeah, as someone who like has the resources or whatever to play by those rules so much so that it becomes invisible, because I mean, money is so ubiquitous that it is invisible and completely easy to forget that you are playing
yes.
by that there's a vernacular and that you are speaking in that vernacular, thinking about in that vernacular, even making like what you see as being like true, honest, like pure bliss choices or whatever, like, but still in the vernacular of you know, the coming and going of money or whatever.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And that is kind of, I'm reading that Zizek book, Living in the End Times right now.
Wow. I've never read anything by him, but people have said I should read it.
Yeah. I mean, he's like a Hegelian / like, post-communist kind of, or just like,
can you explain what that means, Hegelian post-communist?
No. No, that'll get so boring. But he's so good at isolating and illuminating like those types of like invisible bedrock ideas that we live by.
Yes.
That even like even people, not enlightened, but people with a vested interest in like getting as far down to their like lizard brain or whatever you want to
yeah.
call it as possible. But it's really difficult to, or it, the success of a bubble like that is in it's how undetectable it is.
Yes.
And like so many of the bedrock ideas or secret societies or whatever, like their true success is that they're very difficult to like identify because they just permeate.
Right. It's almost completely. Like to if you really want it, once you've been programmed into the bubble, every time you say anything, any sentence that you make is composed of pieces that have been constructed mm-hmm. by this cult.
Yeah.
And so the very act of speaking is almost pledging allegiance to the bubble itself.
Yeah, you have no idea.
So the idea would be that, and this is where the conspiracy theorists say, yeah, that's why there's families. So yeah. You're born into these families and you get this completely different type of conditioning, a sort of administrative conditioning where you're the thing running the machine backstage.
Yeah.
And so there's just no way to, even if you deconstruct it, it's like the idea that a broken machine can't fix itself with the broken machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to, any attempt it makes to fix itself is going to only continue whatever the original error was.
Yeah. Like, there's a telemic view of problem solving versus, like a Copernicus view of changing, like in that with the telemic worldview that, you know, for years and years and years, like everyone was just like trying to make it work that the Earth was at the center of everything and just making all of these like tiny adjustments, like making weird concessions just so that you didn't have to throw everything away and start all over again, even though that was really the only way of creating the best that we can posit of an accurate portrayal of the world. I mean I think we're absolutely in that phase right now where, I mean, American politics and whatever, I view that as being like a broken machine trying to fix itself,
right,
you
right.
know, like, because there is no antidote. The type of problems that arise just out of living in a risk, like we live in a risk economy, like there at, or in a risk culture, like our trans politics, trans everything, there's this social contract. It's just like, we've decided that it's worth it, for the inevitable casualties of a risk society so that some people can enjoy the risk.
Gotcha.
And you know, communism or something was an attempt at remedying that or was an attempt at like not having to put anyone at risk. But in our culture we keep telling ourselves like over and over again that it's not that way. And that's like that kind of ideological mystification where it's like we know that if wealth is based on scarcity, that just rationally some people have to be completely left out.
Yes.
In order to facilitate the benefit of the risk. And politics in general doesn't address that at all. Like it would have you, it sets up this combating dialogue that makes it appear that what we really want is for everyone to be okay. But rationally, the whole thing is predicated on something completely diametrically opposed to that completely. But I mean, this is all just to say that like everyone is walking around, not like just, you cannot deal with the reality. Like American culture is so interesting because it's so ruthless for the most part, but it's such an infantilized time. We haven't had like a war or anything. People are,
it's like going to the best party you've ever been to in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a fucking incredible party. The most
Batman is there.
the most beautiful girls. There's like mainly just hot girls. You and like four of your friends,
yeah.
And like 70 of the hottest girls you've ever met in your life. A buffet of psychedelics. There's a chemist. You know, like in some hotels, they'll have the guy making the omelet.
Yeah,
downstairs. It's
the
like
guy shaving roast beef.
Yeah, there's a guy. Yeah. There's a chemist where you go and you tell him the type of psychedelic you want, and he makes it in
Whoa.
Front of you. It's that great a party, but then you got to use the bathroom. And I want it too. They're like, the bathroom's down the hall to the right, but you get mixed up because you're high. You go down some steps, you open the door, and it's a basement filled with Iraqis being boiled in cauldrons, poor people being pitchforked, screaming, and you've got to make a decision at that point.
Yeah. Or, and actually, it's an interesting point because there may be some like 70-step process by which what you're enjoying, like, it cannot happen without Iraqis getting pitchforked.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, there are like 70 steps between, and you have to make a value judgment where you're like, well, how many steps away from me makes me complicit?
Yeah.
And that's like, that's the like ethical question of the day. And that's what everyone tries to, I mean, everyone benefits from that. Like, there are so many steps away from me and like a sandwich wrapped in cellophane that like, while it may be predicated on cruelty, there's enough of a buffer. But the problem is with thinking about like total and complete complicity is it can totally immobilize you. Like if you, because there is like in everything that you enjoy, enough steps away from that, there is suffering and yes. and pain and whatever.
Yeah.
You have to, yeah, you really have to discern like how many steps away you're willing to deal with.
Yeah, and what you're gonna do, and it's and that is the, so that creates the cognitive.
I mean, there almost is nothing to, yeah, and the real problem that there's like really almost nothing that you can do, and in a bedrock, like one of those bedrock ideas kind of way, we're told that like we can alleviate that suffering, chiefly through our consumer choices.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean? Where it isn't, where that's what we're told is like. Just the best way to prevent pain, suffering, exploitation, etc., is to like, yeah, it's not to like not buy. It's yeah, it's to buy the just more and more ridiculous. You know, it purely a consumer antidote to global pain, which is
yeah.
I mean, at that point, you've lost the war so hard.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure, because that's just the way. Yeah, there's I saw some kind of an essay. I don't remember where I saw it, but it was this essay about this new. The new form of charity where you go to Starbucks and they're like, yeah, every time you buy, in fact, I just bought a bag of coffee from Starbucks that has apparently in some way helped people get jobs. I don't remember how, but it's like, you know, 5 cents for every bag of the bag of coffee you buy helps Americans get jobs.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so the idea is like it used to be people would give charity as separate from buying, but now
I mean, we have given charity over completely to the corporate model.
Yeah.
And the embedded message, like Rousseau has, it's in Emile or something. I don't know how to pronounce it, but he says like be wary of the philosopher who loves the Tartars in order to dispense with having to love his neighbor or something.
What's a Tartar?
That's like a foreign people group or something.
Oh,
it's like
I see.
Kind of like a
like
a jokey reference.
I gotcha. But I agree with that. That's starving African baby syndrome, which is where you're so concerned about the starving African babies that you're not being nice to people around you.
Yeah, because there's a message there that's like if you do like it's this really like quick interaction of guilting you, catching you at a time when you're getting like a little buzz off of a consumer, like a consumer interaction. You're already getting some like little dopamine glandular burst or something from like buying something, and then you think like, well, it's so easy. And the idea is to like guilt you in that like little vulnerable spendy moment. And then to immediately, like, eviscerate the guilt so that it doesn't have to be thought about anymore.
Wow.
You know, it's the real message is just... And that's like seeing starving babies on TV and stuff. It's just like, just do it now and then stop thinking about it. If you do it now, you can just stop thinking about it. So easy. Just do it and then stop thinking about it.
You've done what you can do.
Yeah.
Go back to the buffet, enjoy an ecstasy omelet, and let's have some fun.
Who calls those helplines and then goes back to just watching whatever shit they're watching on TV? Like, that's what, because when I'm watching TV like that, I'm generally considering like the sick, sad state of the world or whatever. But calling, I can't imagine, and I have a hard time imagining myself like calling, going through the, and then like really considering the plight of people in other countries, and then like going back to watching whatever the hell is on TV, and really feeling like, really feeling great, or I don't know.
Because it's always some shitty movie. It's like fucking Police Academy. It's like it's 10-minute commercial in between Police Academy. It's always Drek that you're watching anyway.
What would your life look like if you followed the prompt of every message that was shown like at that hour? Like whether it was like for-profit college. Like if you took an hour of TV and just like followed the prompt of every subliminal message in that hour, you'd end up like... you'd end up with like a worthless nursing degree from a for-profit college.
Some incredible cleaning
like,
products.
Yeah, you'd be, your house would be like completely devoid of any bacteria, and your kids would like die of some like immune deficiency disease.
Yeah.
You'd have a superiority complex.
Oh,
over,
for sure.
Like, you know, all the money that you get.
Oh, you'd have like certificates all over your wall with pictures of the starving kids you're paying for, the letters that they write you when you give 20 cents or. Yeah, man.
So many loans.
But then where it gets really dark with the charitable stuff on TV is that legally, when you have a charity, you only have to give a small percentage of the money you're making to that charity, and the rest goes to pay for the charity. And paying for the charity is just paying for the people running the charity. So those are for-profit businesses anyway.
Yeah, and there's another message there where it's just, you know, there's always a ready answer for those problematic aspects of like organized charity or whatever, and that's that the people that are working there have decided to use their time and their life in this really charitable, selfless way, and like even just supporting those people. There's so many. Oh my god, yeah,
it's a rabbit hole, man.
It is.
Did you now? Here's where it gets really interesting: is if you consider the idea that evolution has not stopped, and that evolution takes place not just in, you know, human there's sociological evolution that happens, and so we know for sure, this isn't a conspiracy theory, we know for sure that since humans have organized into tribes, there have been tribes that had the impulse to take over other tribes, and this led to imperialism, and we know that there's some desire and power to do the classic take over the world. And so one really creepy thing I read once is that in Japanese dynasties, they would actually plan ahead by generations, like generations ahead. Instead of, here's my plan for the next year, they would be like, here's our plan in three generations where we want to be.
Right.
So if that's true, then you would analyze.
See that here.
Yes.
I mean, because every fucking politician, like what you hear, or the analog to that type of thinking in America speak, is like making the world a better place for our grandchildren,
right,
and our grandchildren's children, and that's just nation building, that's just imperialism, that's
right.
You know,
but also the other idea is, aside from what they're saying to the cult, to the cultists about the children, there's another version of it, which is that if you're an emperor, you know, if you went back in time and you talked to Caesar or Napoleon and you're like, hey, listen, we're going to give you another chance to do this. You're really going to get a shot to take over the world. How are you going to do it? The first thing they're going to realize is like, oh, number one, I don't want anyone to know I'm the fucking emperor, because that gets you in trouble. That gets you stabbed to death. That gets you exiled on an island. Yeah. Fuck that. I'm going to get somebody else to be the emperor this time, and I'm going to tell them what to do because I've got the experience. Mm-hmm. And even better, I know that the populations, they don't respond well to emperors. They don't like emperors. They end up overthrowing them. So let's give them the impression that there are no more emperors and that they're running the show.
Yeah.
Then they won't have anyone to overthrow. And if there's no one to overthrow, they'll eternally and perpetually be enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when you, that's the, that again, that's where you get to that place of cognitive dissonance where you've seen into the basement, which Julian Assange gave us all a nice picture into the basement for a second. Anytime information leaks, we get a glimpse into the basement. That's where it creates the cognitive dissonance. It's like, hey, guess what? You got to fucking do something. You got to do something more than buying goddamn Toms of Maine or whatever the fuck you're buying. And that's where again, you get back to that place where if we die and this thing turns out to just be a test or a computer program or some kind of massive fucking test to see if we were worth anything, they're going to look at us like, what the fuck were you doing, man?
Yeah.
You spent all your fucking time eating cupcakes and fucking hipsters when you were supposed to be actually fermenting a true revolution to overthrow. Yeah. I'm just kidding, federal government. I love you guys. We don't want you to overthrow you. You're great.
I mean, it is brilliant that I mean, in terms of the broken machine fixing itself analogy, there's a you can't what's so frustrating about like a singular figure who can be overthrown is a lot more tenable than kind of what we have now, which is corporate entities, like money is basically running the show, and we're so entrenched in that. It's like this feedback cycle or something, but everything is done not by the whims of a leader or by any kind of like ideological core, but just purely by want. And I think that can be evidenced very easily by the fact that we do live in like that some of us or this country, I mean, whatever, arguably the most convenient, easy to live in country in the world.
The best.
And everyone spends all of their time considering the ways in which they can make their lives easier and more convenient. And that is, I mean, that's what capitalism does. I mean, it doesn't work without that.
Right. No, you got to have people keep buying shit or the thing falls apart. Like,
right. And that's kind of the thing running the show. And we don't have to really be coerced or strong-armed into doing that, which is problematic in that it doesn't foster the same kind of resentment, unless we saw some kind of violent overthrow from the lower class. Want doesn't, and being in a state of constant want doesn't foster like a sense of true dissatisfaction, because the want is so readily available to be fulfilled.
Well, right. I mean, that's great.
Like want without dissatisfaction,
it's fantastic.
Is perfect.
It's a fantastic thing if there's true autonomy and if the people who are doing the wanting, it's an authentic want springing up inside of them, like the want for water or the want for food. But then where it gets weird is these corporations have so much money and they've invested so much money in understanding human psychology that it gets into a question of like, is it real want or is that some want that gets blasted into you? Because when you go driving down the street in LA, you can't look anywhere without seeing something that someone's trying to sell to you.
Yeah.
And if you're listening to TV or listening to the radio, it's a constant stream of things that you should buy. It's like an endless stream of things that you should buy. So in that way, it's like, well, they are definitely making a concerted effort to instill that want inside of us.
Yeah, I was laying in bed yesterday, just peacefully laying in bed, and a blimp flew like past the window, and it said it was like a Bacardi or like a Bacardi blimp or something.
Yeah,
and I was thinking like, you know, there should be some cutoff point for companies where it's like, no one is going to stop buying alcohol. Like, no one is going... Like, you did it. You did it. Good job.
Yeah.
From here until the end of this thing, everyone will be pouring Coke down their gullets. Like, it will never stop at this point. Like, no one... If just rationally, it's like, what is... What's, like, the primal purpose of advertising? And that's to, like... let someone know that you have a product or something. But I guarantee...
Oh, wait, hold on one second, though. Here's a crazy thing I heard about that. It's not... Because I would always think that, too. Like, what the fuck? Like, You don't need to keep showing your goddamn thing. We get it. It's out there. I use it. I'm going to use it forever. Right. But that's like, that's the idea that what they're doing is just trying to remind you. But there's another idea.
Well, I know that it's not that. Well, go on. Yeah.
So the idea is that attention, human attention, has metaphysical, magical qualities that when the attention is turned towards a symbol, which the advertisements that they're using is a form of sigil. So, you know, in chaos magic, there's the idea of like you create this magical sigil, and that's like that has potency if you focus on it, if you focus on the thing, because you take like something you want, some idea, some pronouncement or some kind of affirmation, then you like distill it down into its condensed freebase form, and then by gazing on it while you're, a lot of people say when you're coming, like you as you're having an orgasm, as you're gazing at the thing, it like actually brings you close, it brings that, it grows the thing out of the soil of potentiality. So the idea is these advertisers have figured that out a long time ago, and they just want our attention on the shit because it keeps it active.
I love thinking about somebody see, like, I wonder how long it's been since anyone in this country saw a commercial for Coke or something and was like, what is that beverage? That looks delicious. That beautiful woman is just guzzling it down. I should try this. I'm going to try it. When I go, I've seen it at the store. I want to try it. It looks really good. I have no idea what it tastes like.
God, what a great feeling that is. You only get to find out about Coke once.
But imagine, because it's been so long. It's been so long since, I mean, like, the traditional, like, my whatever antiquated traditional perspective I have on, like, what advertising fulfills, like, like in a rational way, like what it should do, what an advertisement should do, how that makes sense to my rational mind. You know, like the commercials don't, it doesn't tell you what's in it, doesn't tell you what it tastes like, doesn't tell you like what purpose it serves or whatever. It's purely just these abstract messages like live now or like taste the excitement or like whatever. I don't even know what Coke's current,
like fashionable sort of like simple ideas that anyone with like you'd like today's your day.
Yeah, right.
Like, what the fuck is
it? Is the now always love? They use love a lot.
Oh yeah,
that's so shameful.
But you know, anyway. You know, I was just thinking that something that made me really paranoid is like, what if this Coke conversation we just had, we're actually sponsored by Coke? And they're just like, yeah, just talk about it. We don't fucking care how you say it.
I know, yeah. That's the problem.
Well, that's the problem with all this goddamn rape talk. Have you noticed that rape has really made a big like jump into the media these days? Have you noticed that?
No, I don't pay attention.
That's good. There's a Senator Todd Akin. Well, there's a few things that just happened in the world of rape, which is like Daniel Tosh, a comedian, made some dumb rape joke, and someone made a blog about it, and then that just created this rape fury, and he ended up having to make an apology.
Right.
Because the idea is like, you know, one third of the audience has been raped, so you shouldn't talk about rape, which creates this freedom of speech idea, which is like, yeah, but you get to say whatever you want on stage.
Right.
And so, but now, to the newest rape scandal that's happened is a senator named Todd Akin was on some, he's a Republican senator. He was on a, I don't remember what news show, but the moron said that, well, you know, a woman can't really get pregnant from, like, getting raped.
Oh,
like, her body shuts down and keeps the rape from happening.
Oh,
so I mean, it's great. I mean, it's great when one of those idiots does that because it, like, just humiliates all of them, and it's so funny, and now they're having to tell him, hey, maybe you shouldn't run. You got to like step out of the race, but he's like still going to do it because he's like, I'm not going to let the liberal elites tell me about rape.
Yeah.
So, but what ends up happening is what's happening right now on this podcast is we talk about rape. It's all over the news. And then you're bringing attention to the thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like,
absolutely.
You're like, you're causing the fucking thing to vibrate in some way.
I do think that satire has like a really, power. I think that satire can be like a powerful antidote to that type of thinking, though. Because, like, if you can make people laugh at the absurdity or wickedness or stupidity of any given thing, and I feel like that kind of reconfigures the circuitry or something in the way that someone thinks about...
Pops the balloon.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, because a really funny idea will supersede a really sentimental idea almost every time, I think.
Oh, yeah. It totally... Yeah. It immediately removes any of the juju from it.
Yeah.
And leaves it... I mean, that was like Carlin's... One of the things I loved about George Carlin is that he would... instead of just taking like sentimental ideas and popping the balloon, he popped every balloon. Mm-hmm. He was such an absurdist that he would just pop everything until you're just back in the void again, wondering if what anything is.
Yeah. That's, yeah, you have to, yeah, making people terrified of themselves, that's a big Marx idea.
But what you do is the comedian's goddamn dream, because we're damned to fucking, we're damned to the punchline, and some of us have managed to, like, overcome that, and there, some of us have pulled it off, like Bill Hicks, but it's very rare. You're damned to the specific form, whereas and I'm sorry, this I can't believe this is the second half of the podcast and we're going to start talking about your music. You, just please let me flatter you for a second, because I got to tell you, I very rarely find new music where I'm like, oh, I'm going to listen to this for the rest of my life. This is fucking incredible. And usually the music that I find is like, it's from a long time ago, you know, like Leonard Cohen or Joni Mitchell, or, and more recently, like Lou Barlow or the Holy Sons. I'm a fan of this band, Honey Honey, or like, but it's rare, it's rare, it's rare. So I'll just, on my fucking iPod, it's just like nice. old, now on my iPod, actually Spotify. Now I know you're not supposed to use that, but on Spotify, I'm sorry. But I've been, my friend Ian mailed me your album, and I've been listening only to you for probably 2 weeks now. Your songs are stuck in my head. I've been like listening; it's zinging around in my head, man. Yeah. So, and not only do I like your music because of the how beautiful and folky and there's a resonance to it that I really like, but your fucking lyrics are incredible, man.
Oh, thanks.
They're so deep and profound, because you're able to, so anyway, my whole point in that is that you're able to, like, you have this medium through which you can transmit these ideas where you're not stuck to the comedic form.
Yeah, I feel like that's a I didn't inject any humor into my music for a really long time, kind of for that reason, because I was so conscious of the way in which people marginalize humorists,
right?
Like, because now the good ones don't, like, the good ones get what's going, like, or like certain types of listeners get what's going on and understand, like, the intellect and in some cases the melancholy or whatever that informs, like, a really good sense of humor. But for the most part, people have a very cartoony, like, margin. Like, the minute something becomes funny, it becomes marginalized, more or less, and doesn't really have it. It's merely amusement. Like,
interestingly enough, the moment comedy becomes sentimental, it's fucked.
It's over. It's awful. Anytime I do watch, like, a network, or like, if on tour or something, I end up watching, like, a network comedy or something, it seems like the last, like, 6 minutes of every show is devoted to this kind of sentimental backpedaling away from whatever unsanctimonious or irreverent or unorthodox, like, kind of ideas or whatever that were presented in the first half of the America. It's so infantilized, where it's like, oh, no, but it's okay. Like,
horrible.
These are the things that are real still. Sentimentality in general. I think a few years ago I reached some new understanding. Like, I think a lot of musicians who play sentimental music, or there's like an excess of sentimentality in their music, is some weird kind of narcissism to elicit the compassion or sympathy or something of the listener. And it isn't so much about entertaining as it is creating like some sense of wonderment around this like bruised angel that you're listening to. But it isn't entertainment. It isn't edification. It isn't like enlightenment.
It just isn't good. No, it's just not coming. It's coming from a fucking, it's like sometimes people will make stuff because they want people to think they're brilliant.
Right.
And sometimes people will make stuff because they want beautiful things to be in the world.
Right.
And that, when you start doing that, you go into this place where, for lack of a better word, I think you go a little crazy. And so it's when in your music, and I mean this in the highest way possible, I can hear that you went deep to make these lyrics come out. It feels like you went deep into the trance to bring this stuff into the world. And you, once you've done that, the music lives on its own. Yeah. And if you don't do that, you've got what? You've got whipped cream.
Right. For me personally, I had to go way past my vanity or something, because it really was this long-standing fear that if people found out that I was funny, that it would completely undermine my ability to be taken seriously or respected or any of that I'll just speak for myself, like in my early 20s or whatever, I just like hated myself or something. There was just so much self-loathing, and not like in a dramatic way, but in bedrock ways that I wasn't even conscious of. Like anything that came to me naturally, I assumed was not artistically credible or like creatively viable. Those were like just, I fragmented all the parts of myself, and it was like, well, all these things that come to me kind of, these things that come to me by virtue of pain or depression or self-loathing or self-analysis or anything, those are the parts of me that belong in my music, which made so much sense, but it's so backwards. But I think by virtue of something about like getting older or so, I mean, I hate to just like chalk it up to that, but it was primarily like just not really caring about being taken so goddamn seriously anymore.
And the effect is that you now, you must be being taken a million times more seriously,
right?
It's shit's so good.
It's
man.
So much. Yeah, I mean, it's, well, it's using that. That's what I'm good. That's the way. That's my conversational voice. That's my sensibility.
But reeling in those fish, what you're talking about is like, it's like you get these instincts to create something. And there's the initial beautiful instinct, and that instinct is followed by a million reasons not to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, and I used to not understand that. I remember reading something, and someone's like, oh, he was a very courageous author. And I remember thinking, like, what the fuck? Courageous bullshit. You just write down some shit. And that, now I understand exactly what they mean. Because to really decide to put yourself out there, you do risk a kind of humiliation, and you also risk like your peers maybe like rolling their eyes at you or you know, so it's a very spooky place to be.
It was definitely like by the time I was ready to do this, I was like rubbing my hands and really enjoying the prospect of like confusing everyone. There was some real excitement in blowing everything up. I mean, like I was ready to like plunge the knife and drink the blood and put an end to it all, like in a very public way, and just, you know, it's some type of very like ceremonial thinking surrounding it all.
Well, here's you know, do you ever read any Aleister Crowley or any of that stuff? So he's got this great essay on sacrifice, and it's an essay that is like, that haunts me because I know some people take it seriously, but you know, whenever you start going down the path of studying the occult, you know that these people, when they write things, they're not writing anything to be taken literally necessarily.
No, yeah.
It's all encoded. But, you know, he talks about how the greatest sacrifice is a child sacrifice. And what you're talking, and I've always, I recognize what I'm going to decide he's saying is that he's talking about the naive, innocent part of yourself that you've been putting out into the world.
Yeah.
You know, this is who I am. This whatever the thing is you've been showing, he's saying, take that fucking thing, plunge a dagger through its heart, and just like you said, drink its blood, and that's who then you'll become your true self, what you're meant to be.
Yeah, and that's the difference between, I mean, just what we were talking about earlier. Like there are two approaches to like a revolution, be it personal or otherwise. And one attempt is just constant tinkering and constant just marginal adjustments here and there, and but being able to like hold on to this precious thing that you've had around for so long and worked so hard or whatever, like I'm doing air quotations, but it's so precious, and it's still got so much vanity in it, because you're still just giving so much significance to this thing, to your time. It's like your time isn't really shit. Like moments of inspiration happen in an instant. They are singular. It's not, they have nothing to do with quantifiable time spent on whatever, you know, that you can,
Well, no, what you're saying there is like, I know exactly what you mean. Those little lightning bolts are those are the seeds, and the time is relative to that is meaningless.
Yeah, yeah. There's no. What I've found is that there's very little foreseeable run up to a moment of inspiration or a moment of clarity. Or whatever.
Oh man, because if there was foreseeable run up, fuck man, we'd be set.
God.
You know, you'd know exactly what to do, the movements to make. I'd do anything.
You'd feel great the whole way up to it.
Oh yeah, because you're building up to your moment of inspiration.
Dude, I'm coasting.
Yeah, it's like, because when you're working out at the gym, you know, if I work out at the gym and don't eat cakes, there's going to be a change.
Don't eat cakes.
There's going to be a change.
Right. So, yeah, writing this motherfucker was...
See, I didn't realize that inside... I did not... I just put the record on and just have been listening to it.
I'm going
to
make you... I'm going to find a good...
So inside this beautiful album, which you guys should get, I'll put a link to wherever you can get this from on the website, but inside this beautiful album, there is a novel. And I didn't realize that... And you sing about writing the novel in there, too. You sing about that. So what's
you want me to read a chapter?
Yes.
You want me to read a little bit?
I would love it.
Okay, we'll switch over at some point. In the final sun-filled days, this is chapter 22, it's called Pre-Epilogue. In the final sun-filled days of the Dunn and the Sun summer genocide concert series on planet Earth, in which the bedbugs financed a mass migration of those counted among the living to blood retrieval executive sweatshops in what was recently hell proper, the Earth basked and spun silently, save for the austere purr of the occasional jetpack. After a while, the mountains sifted any themed debris that lay between them and down into the bowels of the valley and out on into space, sighing audibly all the while. The bedbugs had decided to undertake a massive renovation of human consciousness, which was to take place inside thousands of weapons-grade modules mounted in deep space. The whole project was funded by the wholesale absorbing of the Earth's economy by the bedbugs daring to inject patented products and advertising that served intensely physiological human needs into a market dominated by worthless intellectual properties. After making a profoundly opaque deal with Satan to purchase Hell and Hell's Restaurant franchise, which served a drug compound rapidly causing a free market-inspired gold rush to Hell, the bedbugs had enough of a blood supply at their disposal to create the vital metadata reduction of DNA the human consciousness required to operate properly. The bedbugs had spent their whole existence observing from the fairly intimate vantage point of mattresses the way our global civilization operates, and decided that for humanity to have one class of people who toil without dignity so that the other class can explore matters of consciousness and awareness of the potentiality for the existence of wishful thinking-inspired alternate realities-related issues at their leisure would be a compassionate and culturally sensitive way to gradually transition them naturally into the next level of their evolution. And then it goes,
Wow! You gonna get assassinated, motherfucker! You gonna get assassinated!
Look out, Jesus, I'm coming. What's up, MLK? See you in a second.
They gonna get you. You can't call them bedbugs.
No, I'm calling them bedbugs. Yeah, totally. That's just like, I'm just, yeah, the bedbugs are basically, this like, it's basically like neoliberalism or something, like these ideas that are so airtight in the way that they're, or these concepts, like basically like buying a chocolate bar that saves an African baby.
Sure.
Like these airtight, like you're not supposed to argue with that, because if you argue with that, there is a system of checks and balances and the social contract in place that anyone can evoke at any time, where if you complain about that, then ergo, you hate African babies, you don't care about anyone but yourself,
right.
Num, 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 jam some more chocolate down your gullet.
Fuck
like,
yeah.
And that's the, and it's that kind of like airtight, and that's why I'm saying, like, it's so, there is, that the enemy is so faceless because it's just so ideological, and we're all kind of, propping it up or something, but the bedbugs really represent
that. Well, the other reason the bedbugs are brilliant is because bedbugs make it uncomfortable when you're trying to sleep.
Yeah.
And it's like this, when you're trying to be in this nice, sedated, fucking hypnotic, capitalist, Western society trance, these motherfuckers will kind of like get in under your skin a little bit, and they like cause you to not enjoy the... That's, man, that is fucking great. It's so good. So this is the entire, this is all, the entirety of the thing?
Yeah.
That is amazing, man. I read on your Wikipedia page that it said that you were chomping mushrooms when you did you write this while you were on mushrooms?
It was like not in a direct, some of it kind of directly, but
speaking of ways to like induce that inspiration, though, there certainly
absolutely
there's lubricant, I suppose, to bring the lightning bolts out.
Yeah, the big moment for me, and a lot of what, and this is like the day before I started writing this book, or actually the day of, I was in Big Sur, which is kind of eye rolly or whatever.
Fuck that. It's the most beautiful place on earth.
It's fucking incredible. I'll keep my audience in mind. I was in the most incredible place on earth, Big Sur. And I was hiking and I was taking mushrooms and like probably, you know, like an eighth or something, like enough to go like, a heroic amount.
Dose.
Yeah. And I was on a hero quest. And I'm like hiking up this mountain and I'm taking my clothes. I'm just like taking all my clothes off the higher I get up, and just staring at bugs. And I get to this tree and I'm totally naked, and I climb up into the tree and I'm sitting there, and I don't know how long I sat there. And I had this real moment of clarity, like this real aha moment of clarity, wherein like the book was conceived. All of a sudden I knew what I needed to do musically, and I also knew that I also had a new understanding, more or less, of like what need to do musically meant, like that I was at some kind of like crisis point, and that music and it's my ability to do it with honesty, there's a lot riding on that for me, you know, for reasons that will sound too sentimental to, you know, explore, but that there's like this that I had gotten way off course or something in my 20s, like regarding music and,
well, you, when you were in your, forgive me for quoting your Wikipedia page, but you did say when you were younger you wanted to become a reverend or a
oh yeah, like real young. Yeah, that would have been like age 8 or something.
You got the call.
Yeah, I was a good bullshitter, and I was like a charismatic kid who didn't like, I didn't, I was so, I don't know, I wasn't, I had no skills or anything other than kind of had this weird like just far, like I was so consumed by religion, by theological, like, while they didn't appear like that at the time, but there are certain kids who are told things about the about God. I remember being in Sunday school and being told and asking the question like, well, who made God? And them saying, and my Sunday school teacher saying, well, God's just always been. And my brain, like that thought, like, while that may have flown by a different type of kid, and what's interesting is that it wasn't, my interest in it wasn't predicated on like devotion or belief or anything. My interest, that was just as close to a concept that would become the kind of issues that I was, like, obviously, I mean, talking to you here now, like, it's obvious that we both are interested in certain,
yes,
you know, whatever, like esoteric topics. And so that interest in that kind of thing gets conflated or confused or something in like, oh, well, you're interested in God or you're interested in religion or, yeah, whatever. It's like, no, I'm not. But those ideas are as close to what I am interested in as, right, I'm getting yet.
Yes. Right. Right. Right.
Yes. Yeah,
that's as close as you're going to get to the metaphysical.
Yeah, but that was all I was interested in. So that was really, I mean, I was so fascinated by God and religion and myth and everything. It was so, but then at some age, there's some age of accountability where it's, you're taught that it's not about that. It's not about the fascination or the wonder or the mystery. It's purely about the devotion, about the faith, about,
right,
you know, like being told to apply what you know about the rational world to like phantoms and,
yes,
you know, ghosts. And
you kind of go
whatever.
From the mystical Sufi Meister Eckhart mystical beautiful place, yeah, to this kind of like stolid dark place,
yeah,
that it,
yeah,
gets all
Jesus
crusty.
Is a historical figure,
yeah,
he
boring
lives in your heart,
but, yeah, but you, so now you're, I want to go back to this thing, you really are on the, like, you've done the archetypical thing, you've gone out into the wilderness to commune with the universe, mm, you've stripped your clothes off, you're sitting in Big Sur staring off, and you get this huge revelation. And that's, did you already know you were going to be Father John Misty at that point?
No,
because Father John Misty, it's like this is a like, you're a reverend now.
Yeah.
You gave yourself that title. Did that happen there?
No, it was, that was really like that. The story behind that, behind just the name for it, is it was like the last aspect of the whole thing. It was like when I was talking to labels or so. By that, like, the album was massive. It was all in the can, and they're like, "Well, what are you going to call it?" And so I was kind of chewing on it for a few days, and a friend of mine was over, and I like looked up from the kitchen table, and I was like, "Father John Misty?"
Yeah.
And he was like, "No." And I was like, "Yes."
<It's> great.
It was just so absurd. I mean, it's really the whole, it's a gag. In that, because I made all these albums under my own name for so long, and I'm not sure that there's, and while those are like honest, I had just like a more immature idea of what honesty really looked like at the time, and they're honest in that regard, but I wasn't actualized. There was no like actualized person at the core of it. There was kind of someone like playing pin the tail on the donkey with their psyche or something, and that is kind of what those albums sound like. But the idea that you can make like an explicitly honest record and give it some patently absurd name, it's kind of just a gag about identity. And I'm really leaving my listener with the check, where it's like, well, are you going to apply significance to this name or
I
not?
Did.
You know? Yeah. I mean, but that's great. Like,
because when you like something, you're like, fuck yeah, that's Father,
yeah,
goddamn John Misty.
Yeah.
You better believe it is.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, on some like pragmatic level, I thought it was funny that there was a name in there that was like etymologically so close to my name, like John.
Yeah.
And then Josh or Misty is like, they're all like deeply sub. I wanted to go. The reason that combination of words bubbled up from my subconscious are, I think, interesting, like why they configured in that way in my brain, why they all came out at the same time. And definitely, like, I think the father thing is like, as loath as I am to admit it, it bubbled up from my subconscious because it does have like religious significance.
Yeah.
It is loaded. It's totally loaded. And then combining it with Misty, which is like a stripper name, or something. And like when I was growing up, there was this book series called, like, I grew up in Maryland. There was this book series called like Misty of Chicoutique about these wild horses who lived on these islands off the coast of Maryland. And that idea was always like, I mean, that, God, the idea of like a wild horse named Misty just like stuck into my, just it stuck in my subconscious craw. Still have dreams of like a horse, just whatever. So, but it's really just the name choice was like a continued exercise in like celebrating my instincts or my impulses or something.
Well, yeah, let me, here's one thing, man. Strippers, and I don't mean this in a cheesy way, because I don't, when I go to strip clubs, I've said this before, last time I went to a strip club, I got drunk and cried. But strippers are mystical beings, man.
Oh, dude.
They have so much, like, they have so much strange potency.
I know.
Anyway, that's a thing.
What club do you like? What club?
This
do you
was
like
at the Spearmint Rhino in Vegas, and I just gotten out of a relationship, and my friends like trying to do the like, we're gonna cheer you up.
Oh,
let's take you to the darkest place on earth.
These boobs are making me feel better.
Yeah.
There's so much about strippers in this book.
Yeah, man.
Because I think stripping, we're all stripping. I mean, not, you know, it's a fairly easy like metaphor, but I mean, we're all working at the strip club.
Oh, yes.
We are all working at that fucking strip club.
That's right.
We're all taking our most like vulnerable bits and like shaking them around in front of people, just hoping and praying that they're good enough for faceless losers who visit strip clubs like to love and approve of.
I'm gonna start crying again.
I mean, we are all strippers.
You're bringing
Jesus
me back.
Christ.
You're bringing me back.
What's the most beautiful part of myself that like that I have to offer?
Let me sell it to
you.
Yeah,
like please.
I'll put it on eBay.
I don't care who you are, just want it. You know? Like, I don't care who you are, I don't care what you're like, just all I need from you is to want this thing that only I can have and do.
Listen, man, this is the fucking problem, though, man. This is the problem of being in the goddamn cult we're in, man, is that they teach us to commodify everything. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to interact except through commodification. It's a real mess.
Yeah.
But there's got to be something more than that, you know? There has to be something more than that.
There always... I mean, every time in human history has, like, obstructions... I mean, we live in a, like, they're just as accessible to us as they've always been. I mean, we all know we're headed towards the end, you know? I think part of keeping, like, a cool head and part of, like, finding value is in knowing that or something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, every religious movement has been about like the freedom that can be found at knowing that one is at the end and that it's not, and that everything's temporal, you know. I'm into that.
Yeah, me too.
I don't think it's so bad.
I think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I think it's the best damn thing there is to realize that, you know. Because you know, the choice between being a temporal thing and being an immortal thing, it's like a clear decision,
because that's where despair comes from. That's where the despair in this culture comes from, is this fear that we're not going to be able to maintain this way of life forever and ever and ever for our children and our grandchildren, whatever. And that, because we know that it's not true, and that dissonance is what creates like the despair and the malaise and the fear and the like nom nom nom, give me there, you know, like but knowing, like, yes. So anyway,
so knowing,
that's what I'm
saying. The fragility. It's like knowing that it's that moment with where you are falling in love with someone, and you know this is not gonna last, and that creates the beautiful moment that makes it so precious.
Yeah.
And the moment you try to like, that's when relationships get fucked up. Is when you're like, we're gonna be together forever.
Isn't it crazy? Yeah. Well, what's crazy is that. That's where we place the value of the thing is in its capacity to last forever.
Yeah.
Which is something that we, instead of The moment. I mean, we all have like, being able to appreciate a moment is definitely a lost art in this culture. Like, everything is judged by its likelihood of reaching the end game, you know, or its sustainability. So we're so obsessed with sustainability, and then nothing that we do, no activity that we undertake has anything to do with sustainability. It's all about like now want. And then when it comes to, and the moment we think about something abstractly, we think about it lasting forever.
Do you know that poem Ozymandias?
Uh-uh.
Oh, it's so great. I don't have it memorized, but it's like someone writing about stumbling upon the feet of some massive statue in the desert. The thing's gone except for the feet, and written on the carved into the statue are the words something like, "Behold, I am Ozymandias, the great. I was Ozymandias, the greatest king. Behold, you mighty and despair." It's like nothing, man. Nothing's left, bitch. Yeah. I messed up the poem. Check it out. I'll put a link on the website. Where do people find you? You got a website that they could go to? Or?
There's like a myriad of online presences.
Let's
there's
hear
like
them.
A Twitter.
What's your Twitter?
At Father John Misty, which is fun. It's a fun Twitter feed. But there's like FatherJohnMisty.com. Mostly I direct people towards the Twitter or something.
I'll have all your links on my site. I'm going to, everyone, please, if you are going to buy an album this year, buy Fear Fun. It is the most incredible album. You will not stop listening to it. The songs will stay stuck in your head in the best way possible. Thank you very much, man. This is such a pleasure.
Such a pleasure.
Awesome.
Thanks,
cool. Here is Hollywood Forever Cemetery Sings from Father John Misty's album Fear Fun, available on iTunes. Links will be on my website. See you guys later.
The marble in my cheeks look pain.